In 1979, that group, I call them the 9%, had 2.5 times medium incomes. By the time Margaret Thatcher left office, they had 3 times medium incomes. People above them have done much better, but they have been rewarded. You can run or control a country if you take the whole 1% with you, the whole 10% with you. What's been happening since 2008, and again I say I think this is cocker because it isn't a sensible way to try to do things, is that for the first time for this 100 years, you've got this split at the top. Because child benefit's gone from the rest of the 10%, because of changes in national insurance, because employees won't pay so much. The 1%, half of them never bothered to claim child benefit. It wasn't worth the effort. They've had a tax cut, which hasn't affected the rest, and so on. This is, I labour it because this is unique and I think interesting. If you're trying to work out where you are on income distribution and you're good at looking at graphs, take your household income. If there's two of you, work your way along and work your way down, and you can work out what percentile you're in for the UK distribution. To be in the 1%, if you're a couple, you need a household income before tax of £160,000 a year. That just gets you into the 1%. And that's the group we're talking about. Now, the 1%, of course, are very, very geographically unevenly distributed. There are some in Scotland, but not that many. The vast bulk are in London or just around London, and they don't feel like they're the 1%, partly because locally they are not the 1%. Locally there are other people like them, and in fact they often feel very poor because buying a three-bed house on the edge of Mayfair isn't possible on £160,000 or even double that. At the other extreme, at the top, the middle of the 1%, the median is around about £300,000 a year. The top, of course, is the Sunday Times Super Rich List, and they're geographically unevenly distributed. If you take the 16 richest families in the UK, 10 of them are in London, 2 in the South East, and 1 in every other country and region, including the Channel Islands, which has a family as rich as the richest family in Scotland. This isn't normal. This is data about the 1% for different countries. America is the most unequal. The American 1% take 20% of all income in America. Our 1% are now taking 15% before tax, 10% after tax. Germany comes next, and if you look right at the bottom, you'll see the Netherlands as being the country where the 1% take the least. You're often told there's a global race, inequality is rising everywhere, it's the only thing possible. Don't be fanciful, you can only do it one way. The data shows a huge range of differences in different countries and what people are willing to put up with. Here's an attempt to look at wealth. This is the kind of thing that Piketty got in trouble with the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago. I thought I was ever so clever when I started doing this work on the 1%, because I discovered this obscure French economist called Piketty, who produced all this stuff. So I'm completely useless now for blowing my own trumpet. But this is an attempt using the kind of data that he uses to show the level of inequality in this country in terms of wealth. It's much, much harder to look at wealth. And the reason for producing that map is to copy a famous American map, which I'll show you now. America is more unequal than the UK. This really matters because my feeling is that the current plan of the Westminster parties is to become more like the USA. Now, maybe in a slightly more humane way, but not to worry too much about it. UK wealth inequality is so unequal that the poorest 40% would only get a tiny sliver. And if you've got very good eyesight, you'll see that the data there is for 2007. And the reason it's for 2007 is that when they got the 2010 data, that bottom 40% had negative wealth. So they literally were drowning in the Atlantic and you couldn't draw the map anymore. And I think American elites began to panic at that point. They found this out around about 2012. You had 40% of the population who had less than nothing to lose. If you stuck in their main residence, their equity and housing, the wealth of the bottom 40% got even worse because they had net debts on what little property that they owned. It was after these kind of figures came out that tax rates were finally increased by Obama. Some things began to happen. We may now be back to this situation, but it's extreme. The UK is very, very unusual when it comes to wealth. Here's one particular estimate of 100 million dollar households. The US has the most, but we, with a smaller population than Germany, have the next highest, and you can see the rest of the distribution. The Sunday Times list and the Forbes list of billionaires that's come out most recently says there's been a dramatic and huge increase in the concentration of wealth in the last couple of years of people in and around London. And the UK, in a way, runs like a tax haven. It qualifies for one of the official definitions of what a treasure island is, what the Cayman Islands are, and so on. The actual whole of the UK qualifies under one definition of this as a way that you can shelter your money. And there are particular things going on at the moment which are short-term and maybe heightening this. The most important could be that the Swiss authorities have agreed to open up the bank accounts within the next 18 months to America, which means should you happen to have some money in a Swiss bank account that you shouldn't really have there and you want to get it out and you need somewhere to put it, buying a flat in London is very attractive. So there are possibilities about why it spiked so recently. Here's one of these Piketty graphs. It shows the changing share of income of the best off 1% in the United States and how regulations changed on financial behaviour. Two things were in line. And here's the data again around that spat between the Financial Times and Piketty about wealth. It's really hard to work out the wealth of the top 1%. We know, in case you want to know if you're in the 1% by wealth, if you've got a spare £1 million, that is money not tied up in your main residence or in your pension, you just about qualify to get in. But we don't know what the average is. ONS released some data by accident, which suggested it might be 15 million. And then withdrew it because they really don't know, because so much of the money is so well hidden. But I think it's worth putting the graph up and saying, until we get proper data, this is the graph. Sorry I'm a bit graph heavy on this, but it's hard to do these things without showing you the numbers. And I don't think you'd believe it if I didn't actually show you the graphs, and you may well not believe this even having seen the graphs. This little orange graph here comes from the Social Mobility and Child Poverty Commission, which is a body of government, Alan Milburn's commission. And it's showing you the proportion of households in England that have got children, so it's like families with children, renting privately each year from 1984. And it's now over a quarter. Look how fast that proportion rose. And that happened at the same time as landlords are buying up all these properties. Now, England had a private rented sector which was too small. Most European countries had a larger one. But the idea of having a large private rented sector is for young professionals or for couples to be able to move around easily, or even, although we don't talk about it very much, to help you downsize when you get old and your health begins to deteriorate in ways which are unpredictable so that you can easily move between property. That happens in other countries. It doesn't happen here because we have no decent rights to be able to stay in, so you wouldn't expect an elderly person to rent privately. Private renting was not designed for families with children because children need to stay in the same area because it's not good for children to move school repeatedly and lose all their friends and have to make new friends. I probably don't have to explain that to you, but to some audiences in London, they just say, well, the market's good, isn't it? It's efficient. And they don't think about a child being moved around London. Average London tenancies are now at a year. Moving on average a year, every year. And the people who end up having to move are families with children because they've got children, they've got to buy their children food and clothes, which means they can't pay quite as much rent, which means that they're constantly being beaten by couples without kids, and they have to move down the hierarchy. So that's the first graph. I think, just to push it home, that needs to be worried about. This kind of thing is going on and is largely not discussed, not seen as a problem, seen as market liberalisation, it's okay. This is unusual, and this is the kind of point coming back to Scotland. If you are talking about becoming independent from an average European country in an average way of behaving, that's different from talking about becoming independent for a country that allows this to occur and doesn't worry about it that much. That's what worries me about England. Two more of these strange maps, and I promise no more. This is what the Netherlands looks like. The Netherlands is the middle country when it comes to the 90-10 ratio of inequality. It's of the 25 richest countries in the world. If you want a realistic model of a country to aim at, I would say it's the Netherlands. The countries that do much better, we're at the bottom of the class. It's a long way away from them. And I can say we there because inequality in Scotland and England is very similar. But I would look at the Netherlands as a model of what you might want to look at and what you might want to achieve. It's also denser, higher population density than England is. And here's the income share of the best off 1% in the Netherlands and in Switzerland to the latest data that's been released. And the top 1% have never had less. These are successful countries. There is no need for the very rich to get richer and for you to share things out worse and worse. It's a choice. But the 1% are not very good at controlling themselves. It has to be a choice of a wider group of people in society. The 1% contain a disproportionate number of people who are greedier than average. I don't think it's contentious to say that. It's quite hard to stay in the 1% if you don't feel the need to make more and more money. It requires a wider society to control the 1%. You're always going to have a 1%. They always will be just 1%. The question is, how much do the 1% have? They'll always have the most. These things can be worked out, but they don't have to have as much. Ours have 15% and rising. Last map. Switzerland is interesting in all kinds of ways. Particularly what it's doing with migrants at the moment. I don't see Switzerland as a particularly brilliant model for the future. Of course, it's not Scotland that talks about Switzerland as a model, it's London. And it's becoming less and less of a joke when you hear people talk about London splitting off from the rest of the UK. But Switzerland is used as a model, and Singapore for London. Some more graphs from the USA. This is the tax rate that people on different incomes in the USA were paying over time. You'll see the top tax rates went down at the very high incomes. The top tax rates of the middle 20% actually went up in that early period. So it's a redistribution of income towards the rich that occurs in very unequal countries because the tax rates are manipulated to the benefit of the people who get the most in the first place. And people then become frightened. These are estimates of the pension pots of different Americans. If you want to see where the UK is heading, if it carries on along its current trajectory, it's heading towards an American degree of inequality, an American degree of privatisation, and an American degree of fear about the future of people at the top, because you don't have much future if you're not very near the top. You can't envisage your children doing a normal job, an average job, because then your child would be relatively poor. And this is happening now in the UK. I think the Children's Commissioner is still the Children's Commissioner. I don't expect them to be in post for much longer, but they keep on producing statements like this. It's well worth looking up from a whole series of facts. And they even produce versions, and this is the reason it's worth looking up, done in a nice font for teachers to put up on classroom walls to explain what's happening. That's why I don't think the Children's Commissioner may stay in post for that much longer. But we're getting these kind of unfairnesses happening because of the huge number of changes of austerity. We haven't done austerity for the better off. less austerity for the worst off. We've done austerity that most affects the worst off. And then you could even add, after lone parents with children, it's lone parents with disabled children, which have lost even more. It looks very callous. Here's the estimates from the Institute of Fiscal Studies about the effects of tax and benefit changes to 2015-17, depending on when universal credit comes in. The Institute of Fiscal Studies is not a radical organisation. The Institute of Fiscal Studies is a group of economists who largely believe in a free market. They just have a model, and they put in all the things that are proposed and press a button, and they get the results out. And the results are drops in the income of all groups apart from the best off 10th. And then when you look at the best off 10th in detail, you find it's only the best off 10th of that group, the 1% who have actually done better because of those changes in child benefit and so on that have meant that the rest of that group are not doing so well. Everywhere in the world, people think inequality is a problem. It's a remarkable rise in perception of this. And the problem with inequality is it's a very diffuse idea. But if you ask people, they say it's a problem. And as soon as I showed this slide, people are fascinated about why one country is where it is and not another. President Obama had inequality as one of the two main issues in the speech he gave, last annual address he gave. The president of China had inequality in the top two places. The Pope had it number one last year. The businessmen who meet at Davos came up with 31 major world problems. And in the top three, they put inequality, climate change, and mass unemployment. And then they had another 28. It's generally becoming accepted that it's gone too far and this is too much of a problem, except amongst a certain group of people in England who go to Brussels and demand that they don't cap the top pay of our English bankers because we can't reward them enough given their brilliance. And it does... It does feel really odd to me. It does feel really odd. It may be me. You know, when things feel really odd, you're at a party and it feels really strange, you think this isn't normal. There's a good chance it's you and you're the strange one. But I just get a feeling that we will look back at these years and say, for a number of years, the English just didn't get it. In a similar way to after the 1929 crash, it took a number of years before people got it that we were not going to return to the situation before 1929. Doesn't happen immediately. I hope there's one more graph after this, so sorry for death by graphs. But these things are all just the numbers, and I have opinions, I have feelings, I have thoughts and things I worry about, but so many numbers are behaving in such odd ways. I've been looking at numbers like this about 25 years. And often the changes are slow and gradual and you're working out quite complicated things because it was pretty boring if you didn't. Then, this is the average number of rooms per person for the best off 10th compared to the worst off 10th, the top graph. And we've just seen a massive increase in housing inequality in England and Wales. That is, poor people being squeezed into smaller and smaller houses, absolute overcrowding of children rising, better off people owning more houses. We're using our housing less efficiently than we were even in 1911, 1921. And so we talk about having to build 200,000 homes a year to house people, because we don't want to talk about the fact that we're using the housing so badly. A little bit of this, by the way, is ageing. So it's really good news. Our housing stock worked incredibly well when we tended to die around about age 75. Now that many of us, particularly women, hang on into our 90s, we need to work out a way of not hanging on in the same house that we had our children in. And that's part of it, but a large part of it is growing inequality. So governments talk about building hundreds of thousands of houses suddenly to solve this. And at the same time, they say they're going to have net immigration of zero. So who are you building these houses for? The last graph, I hope, again from Piketty. It's changed from 1960 to now. On the bottom axis, you've got the decrease in the top rate of tax. In the extreme cases, which is the UK and the USA, the top rate of tax fell by over 40% over this period. And on the y-axis, you've got the increased share of national income going to the 1%. It's a very close relationship. And the point of showing this graph is to make a point about what top taxes are about. Top rate taxes are not about trying to get lots of money. What a top rate tax does is help you, particularly if you're a little bit greedy, help you not ask for a massive pay rise, because you won't get most of it. When we increase top taxes in the first half of the last century, it had an effect of people not arguing up their salaries at the top. So salaries and wages came together because people at the top stayed where they were, people at the bottom with unions fought their way up, and we got closer. When that young banker, was it at Lloyds? Young banker a few months ago, who was on £4 million a year, found out that his equivalent in Barclays was on six and demanded six. It would be easier to explain to the young banker it isn't necessarily a good idea to ask for a £2 million pay rise if that banker knew that they'd only get a very small fraction of that extra £2 million. It helps people who find money very important not try quite as hard to get as much. Having high top tax rates are a deterrent for greed. It's not about raising money. But at the moment, the 1% in the UK contribute 33% of all income tax because they pay themselves so highly. I like this quote because of the end of it. I grew up in Oxford. I left at 18. I've been back for 9 months. It's a really interesting ethnographic study to walk into the town you grew up, but into a different part of it. And to see how part of English society works and who teaches PPE, which is what both of these two young men did. And this is getting back to a debate which, of course, you probably are sick of by now, and you're going to be thoroughly sick of by August. I wonder how much the holiday taking is going to increase in Scotland of people actually going out of the country at an unusual rate. But anyway, that's one little thing I'm looking out for. And that, to me, this gets to part of the nub of the question, which is a lot of what happened in the UK, although the most extreme stuff has happened since 2008, a lot of it happened under New Labour. The income inequality rates in Britain rose from 1997 to 2005, 2006, and so on. There were a couple of years where they managed to hold things a bit still, but they rose under New Labour. So what kind of a political party is it? If it's happy with a society becoming more unequal. You could say things were getting so much worse, it was too hard to do anything about. People at the top of the Labour Party in government in London just didn't understand economics that well. But I don't think people at the top of the Labour Party, particularly the Chancellor who later became Prime Minister, would say he didn't understand economics that well. And I think this is the worry. This is the choice. It's about what can you trust England to do? What is England about? What is England trying to achieve? Where is England trying to become? Is really the game in town to become like the USA? And in which case, what part of the USA will you be if that's where we're heading? The most important thing, if that's the way you think, and you think something else is possible, the next question you have to ask, which I don't know how much it does get asked, is how much like the English are we? Because if people in Scotland are very like the English, and I said the distribution of wealth is remarkably unequal, the distribution of income is pretty unequal, distribution of life expectancy is dramatically unequal. Scotland has some of the lowest life expectancies in Europe, but has an average life expectancy of only 1 year under England's, which tells you that there are a lot of areas doing very, very well. If Scotland or Scottish society is actually rather like English society, for all the differences, then simply by voting yes doesn't necessarily get you away from it. It's a question about how much you trust each other. You could do a thought experiment here where I ask you all to take your purse or wallet out and hand it three or four rows backwards, and then we'll see if they all come back again with the same amount of money in them. And those are the kind of things that people do to look at levels of trust in different countries. But if you don't trust each other, you don't tend to vote for policies which look after each other, because you think some people are feckless and scroungers and others are much more hardworking. And I think this is what people really have to worry about. I call it the are you feeling lucky punk question. I don't have an answer to it, but I think that's what part of the question is about. The other thing I think is really interesting and not talked about much, but you can correct me on this, is what would be the effect of a yes vote, say a very large but still a minority yes vote, or even a majority yes vote, what would be the effect on England? Now, I can tell you, nobody's talked to me about this in Oxford in 9 months, because A, people think it's absolutely impossible to occur, there is no way it will happen, and B, I get the impression they think it doesn't matter very much even if it does happen. It'll be to the disbenefits of the Scots to leave the Union, but England is strong, particularly southern England. It's got its bankers, it's got everything else. It's got the wind and the willows and the nice rivers and two ancient universities, if not four. And it wouldn't have that much effect on England. And I just think it would be really interesting just to begin to talk about what would the impression of England be if there is a relatively large vote, or even a majority vote. Because what other rich country has had a large number of its citizens actually actively choose to want to leave it for some reason? Now, it's not particularly good for the reputation of a country. Add on to that, and I'll get slightly fanciful here, the UK is not a particularly powerful country. It has a national debt that's the same as the national debt of Greece in relation to its GDP. It's just better structured to last for longer. But this is a massively indebted country. It relies on a tiny currency secured entirely on its own lack of sovereign wealth. Nobody talks about a run on the pound anymore. But the pound doesn't feel like a particularly safe thing to me. There are advantages that England has. Time zone is an advantage, the English language is an advantage, the history of London is an advantage. But there are lots of disadvantages which may become more apparent depending on how that vote goes. And one thing that England does is it does things on confidence, it does things on, it's all about market sentiment. The only reason the housing market is so high and holding up is that people believe it should be that high and is holding up. My main interest, I have to say, is about England, and I don't think people talk at all about what might happen to England. Now, I did say, what would Scotland miss? And so I racked my brains, and you can certainly do better than me, because anybody in any country knows what's wrong with their country. And they almost always think there's something wrong with their country. My favourite example is the Norwegians. When I went to Norway, and I opened a talk like this by saying congratulations on having the lowest child poverty rate in the world, and two people shouted, "It's too high," and they were angry. And that's how you get a solidarity society, and that takes a long time. People are very good at talking about what's wrong in their society. You go to Japan, people talk about the inequality and say how terrible it is. They don't know it's one of the lowest rates in the world. So I'm sure you can come up with things that are wrong in Scotland. But I thought I'd come up with one thing, and I'm going to show it you. And the sad thing is that somebody just before this talk told me I might be wrong, but this is what England does better. England has proper, decent, well-organised 20-mile-an-hour zones. Okay? Over 100 local authorities in England have these now. The City of Oxford has them. The City of London has them. Large parts of London have them. Lancashire has them. Around schools, in residential roads, they have enforceable, legal 20-mile-an-hour zones. And what annoys the brilliant campaigners for 20-mile-an-hour in England the most is Edinburgh's absolutely terrible discretionary 20-mile-an-hour zone. So, if you feel like driving at 20, drive at 20. But if you want to zoom past that school, just go for it. So I have this as my example of what could Scotland learn from the English. I then learned 5 minutes before I give this talk that apparently the city council's talking about bringing in proper 20-mile-an-hour zones to Edinburgh, and this will go. So If this is true, you're in a wonderful country already. What are you worrying about? Why are you having that vote in the first place?